Chapter 47. Captain Cuttle does a little business for the young people. Captain Cuttle, in the exercise of that surprising talent for deep-laid and unfathomable scheming, with which, as is not unusual in men of transparent simplicity, he sincerely believed himself to be endowed by nature, had gone to Mr. Dombey's house on the eventful Sunday, winking all the way as a vent for his superfluous sagacity, and had presented himself in the full luster of the ankle jacks before the eyes of Towlinson. Hearing from that individual, to his great concern, of the impending calamity, Captain Cuttle, in his delicacy, sheered off again confounded, merely handing in the nosegay as a small mark of his solicitude, and leaving his respectful compliments for the family in general, which he accompanied with an expression of his hope that they would lay their heads well to the wind under existing circumstances, and a friendly intimation that he would look up again tomorrow. The captain's compliments were never heard of any more. The captain's nosegay, after lying in the hall all night, was swept into the dustbin next morning, and the captain's sly arrangement, involved in one catastrophe with greater hopes and loftier designs, was crushed to pieces. So, when an avalanche bears down a mountain forest, twigs and bushes suffer with the trees, and all perish together. When Walter returned home on the Sunday evening from his long walk, and its memorable close, he was too much occupied at first by the tidings he had to give them, and by the emotions naturally awakened in his breast by the scene through which he had passed, to observe either that his uncle was evidently unacquainted with the intelligence the captain had undertaken to impart, or that the captain made signals with his hook, warning him to avoid the subject. Not that the captain's signals were calculated to have proved very comprehensible, however attentively observed. For, like those Chinese sages who are said in their conferences, to write certain learned words in the air, that are wholly impossible of pronunciation, the captain made such waves and flourishes as nobody without a previous knowledge of his mystery, would have been at all likely to understand. Captain Cuttle, however, becoming cognizant of what had happened, relinquished these attempts, as he perceived the slender chance that now existed of his being able to obtain a little easy chat with Mr. Dombey before the period of Walter's departure. But in admitting to himself, with a disappointed and crestfallen countenance, that Sol Gills must be told, and that Walter must go taking the case for the present as he found it, and not having it enlightened or improved beforehand by the knowing management of a friend, the captain still felt an unabated confidence that he, Ned Cuttle, was the man for Mr. Dombey, and that, to set Walter's fortunes quite square, nothing was wanted but that they two should come together. For the captain never could forget how well he and Mr. Dombey had got on at Brighton, with what nicety each of them had put in a word when it was wanted, how exactly they had taken one another's measure, nor how Ned Cuttle had pointed out that resources, in the first extremity, and had brought the interview to the desired termination. On all these grounds the captain soothed himself with thinking that though Ned Cuttle was forced by the pressure of events to stand by almost useless for the present, Ned would fetch up with a wet sail in good time, and carry all before him. Under the influence of this good-natured delusion, Captain Cuttle even went so far as to revolve in his own bosom, while he sat looking at Walter and listening with a tear on his shirt collar to what he related, whether it might not be at once genteel and politic to give Mr. Dombey a verbal invitation, whenever they should meet, to come and cut his mutton in Brig Plus on some day of his own naming, and enter on the question of his young friend's prospects over a social glass. But the uncertain temper of Mrs. McStinger, and the possibility of her setting up her rest in the passage during such an entertainment, and their delivering some homily of an uncomplimentary nature, operated as a check on the captain's hospitable thoughts, and rendered him timid of giving them encouragement. One fact was quite clear to the captain, as Walter, sitting thoughtfully over his untasted dinner, dwelt on all that had happened. namely, that however Walter's modesty might stand in the way of his perceiving it himself, he was, as one might say, a member of Mr. Dombey's family. He had been, in his own person, connected with the incident he so pathetically described. He had been by name remembered and commended in close association with it, and his fortunes must have a particular interest in his employer's eyes. If the captain had any lurking doubt, whatever of his own conclusions, he had not the least doubt that they were good conclusions for the peace of mind of the instrument maker. Therefore he availed himself of so favorable a moment for breaking the West Indian intelligence to his friend, as a piece of extraordinary preferment, declaring that for his part he would freely give £100,000 if he had it, for Walter's gain in the long run, and that he had no doubt such an investment would yield a handsome premium. Solomon Gills was at first stunned by the communication, which fell upon the little back parlor like a thunderbolt, and tore up the hearth savagely. But the captain flashed such golden prospects before his dim sight, hinted so mysteriously at Wittingtonian consequences, laid such emphasis on what Walter had just now told him, and appealed to it so confidently as a corroboration of his predictions, and a great advance towards the realization of the romantic legend of Lovely Peg, that he bewildered the old man. Walter, for his part, feigned to be so full of hope and ardor, and so sure of coming home again soon, and backed up the captain with such expressive shakings of his head and rubbings of his hands, that Solomon, looking first at him then at Captain Cuttle, began to think he ought to be transported with joy. "But I'm behind the time, you understand," apostrophe he observed in apology, passing his hand nervously down the whole row of bright buttons on his coat, and then up again, as if they were beads and he were telling them twice over. "And I would rather have my dear boy here. It's an old-fashioned notion, I dare say. He was always fond of the sea, hasn't he?" Looked wistfully at Walter. "He's glad to go. Apostrophe, Uncle Sol. Apostrophe, apostrophe," cried Walter, quickly, "if you say that, I won't go. No, Captain Cuttle, I won't. If my uncle thinks I could be glad to leave him, though I was going to be made governor of all the islands in the West Indies, that's enough. I'm a fixture. Apostrophe, Waller, my lad," apostrophe said the captain. "Steady. Sol Gills, take an observation of your navy." Following with his eyes the majestic action of the captain's hook, the old man looked at Walter. "Here is a certain craft," apostrophe said the captain, with a magnificent sense of the allegory into which he was soaring, "a-going to put out on a certain voyage. What name is wrote upon that craft indelibly? Is it the Gay, or," apostrophe said the captain, raising his voice as much as to say, "observe the point of this, is it the Gills?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, Ned," apostrophe said the old man, drawing Walter to his side, and taking his arm tenderly through his, "I know. I know. Of course I know that Wally considers me more than himself always. That's in my mind. When I say he is glad to go, I mean I hope he is. Eh? Look you, Ned, and you too, Wally, my dear, this is new, and unexpected to me, and I'm afraid my being behind the time, and poor, is at the bottom of it. Is it really good fortune for him, do you tell me, now?" Apostrophe, apostrophe said the old man, looking anxiously from one to the other. "Really and truly? Is it? I can reconcile myself to almost anything that advances Wally, but I won't have Wally putting himself at any disadvantage for me, or keeping anything from me. You, Ned Cuttle," apostrophe said the old man, fastening on the captain, to the manifest confusion of that diplomatist, "are you dealing plainly by your old friend? Speak out, Ned Cuttle. Is there anything behind? Ought he to go? How do you know it first, and why?" Apostrophe, as it was a contest of affection and self-denial, Walter struck in with infinite effect, to the captain's relief, and between them, they tolerably reconciled old Sol Gills, by continued talking, to the project, or rather so confused him, that nothing, not even the pain of separation, was distinctly clear to his mind. He had not much time to balance the matter, for on the very next day, Walter received from Mr. Carker, the manager, the necessary credentials for his passage and outfit, together with the information that the Sun and Air would sail in a fortnight, or within a day or two afterwards at latest. In the hurry of preparation, which Walter purposely enhanced as much as possible, the old man lost what little self-possession he ever had, and so the time of departure drew on rapidly. The captain, who did not fail to make himself acquainted with all that passed, through inquiries of Walter from day to day, found the time still tending on towards his going away, without any occasion offering itself, or seeming likely to offer itself, for a better understanding of his position. It was after much consideration of this fact, and much pondering over such an unfortunate combination of circumstances, that a bright idea occurred to the captain. Suppose he made a call on Mr. Carker, and tried to find out from him how the land really lay. Captain Cuttle liked this idea very much. It came upon him in a moment of inspiration, as he was smoking an early pipe in Brig Plus after breakfast. And it was worthy of the tobacco. It would quiet his conscience, which was an honest one, and was made a little uneasy by what Walter had confided to him, and what Sol Gills had said, and it would be a deep, shrewd act of friendship. He would sound Mr. Carker carefully, and say much or little, just as he read that gentleman's character, and discovered that they got on well together or the reverse. Accordingly, without the fear of Walter before his eyes, who he knew was at home packing, Captain Cuttle again assumed his ankle jacks and mourning brooch, and issued forth on this second expedition. He purchased no propitiatory nosegay on the present occasion, as he was going to a place of business, but he put a small sunflower in his buttonhole, to give himself an agreeable relish of the country. And with this, and the knobby stick, and the glazed hat, bore down upon the offices of Dombey and Son. After taking a glass of warm rum and water at a tavern close by, to collect his thoughts, the captain made a rush down the court, lest its good effects should evaporate, and appeared suddenly to Mr. Perch. "Matey," apostrophe said the captain, in persuasive accents, "one of your governors is named Carker." Apostrophe Mr. Perch admitted it, but gave him to understand, as in official duty bound, that all his governors were engaged, and never expected to be disengaged any more. "Looky here, mate," apostrophe said the captain in his ear, "my name's Cap'n Cuttle." Apostrophe the captain would have hooked Perch gently to him, but Mr. Perch eluded the attempt. Not so much in design, as in starting at the sudden thought that such a weapon unexpectedly exhibited to Mrs. Perch might, in her then condition, be destructive to that lady's hopes. "If you'll be so good as just report Cap'n Cuttle here, when you get a chance," apostrophe said the captain, "I'll wait." Apostrophe, saying which, the captain took his seat on Mr. Perch's bracket, and drawing out his handkerchief from the crown of the glazed hat which he jammed between his knees without injury to its shape, for nothing human could bend it, rubbed his head well all over, and appeared refreshed. He subsequently arranged his hair with his hook, and sat looking round the office, contemplating the clerks with a serene respect. The captain's equanimity was so impenetrable, and he was altogether so mysterious a being, that Perch the messenger was daunted. "What name was it you said?" Apostrophe apostrophe asked Mr. Perch, bending down over him as he sat on the bracket. "Cap'n," apostrophe in a deep hoarse whisper. "Yes," apostrophe said Mr. Perch, keeping time with his head. "Cuttle," apostrophe oh. Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Perch, in the same tone, for he caught it, and couldn't help it. The captain, in his diplomacy, was so impressive. "I'll see if he's disengaged now. I don't know. Perhaps he may be for a minute. A, my lad, I won't detain him longer than a minute, said the captain, nodding with all the weighty importance that he felt within him. Perch, soon returning, said, will Captain Cuttle walk this way? Mr. Carker, the manager, standing on the hearth rug before the empty fireplace, which was ornamented with a castellated sheet of brown paper, looked at the captain as he came in, with no very special encouragement. Mr. Carker? Said Captain Cuttle. I believe so, said Mr. Carker, showing all his teeth. The captain liked his answering with a smile. It looked pleasant. You see, began the captain, rolling his eyes slowly round the little room, and taking in as much of it as his shirt collar permitted. I'm a seafaring man myself, Mr. Carker, and Waller, as is on your books here, is almost a son of mine. Walter Gay? Said Mr. Carker, showing all his teeth again. Waller Gay it is, replied the captain, right. The captain's manner expressed a warm approval of Mr. Carker's quickness of perception. I'm an intimate friend of his and his uncle's. Perhaps, said the captain, you may have heard your head governor mention my name? Captain Cuttle. No. Said Mr. Carker, with a still wider demonstration than before. Well, resumed the captain, I've the pleasure of his acquaintance. I waited upon him down on the Sussex coast there, with my young friend Waller, when there was a little accommodation wanted. The captain nodded his head in a manner that was at once comfortable, easy, and expressive. You remember, I dare say? Said Mr. Carker, I had the honor of arranging the business. To be sure. Returned the captain. Right again. You had. Now I've took the liberty of coming here, won't you sit down? Said Mr. Carker, smiling. Thank ye, returned the captain, availing himself of the offer. A man does get more way upon himself, perhaps, in his conversation, when he sits down. Won't you take a cheer yourself? No thank you, said the manager, standing, perhaps from the force of winter habit, with his back against the chimney piece, and looking down upon the captain with an eye in every tooth and gum. You have taken the liberty, you were going to say, though it's none thank ye kindly, my lad, returned the captain, of coming here, on account of my friend Waller. Sol Gills, his uncle, is a man of science, and in science he may be considered a clipper, but he ain't what I should altogether call a able seaman, not man of practice. Waller's as trim a lad as ever stepped. But he's a little down by the head in one respect, and that is, modesty. Now what I should wish to put to you, said the captain, lowering his voice, and speaking in a kind of confidential growl, in a friendly way, entirely between you and me, and for my own private reckoning, till your head governor has wore round a bit, and I can come alongside of him, as this is everything right and comfortable here, and is Waller out are bound with a pretty fair wind. What do you think now, Captain Cuttle? Returned Carker, gathering up his skirts and settling himself in his position. You are a practical man. What do you think? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.